Roger Ward, twice national driving champion and winner of the 1959 and 1962 Indianapolis 500, had this to say about racing.
Requires a desire more than anything else. You have to really want to do this because it's something that is a little bit dangerous, you might say, and however, we don't think of it that way, but it's a profession that you have to want to do pretty bad because there are lots of other ways to make it. In 1955, on the back straightaway, when Billy Vukovich was killed, I slid down the back straightaway backwards. I knew I was going into the wall. I never had enough time to think about it.
Roger retired from auto racing in 1966 after nearly being involved in a 17-car accident. He said that racing wasn't fun anymore. Driving a high-powered race car at tremendous speeds, lap after lap, is a hard, grueling business. And in both qualifying and racing, a driver must know how he is to drive this track. We asked several rookies if they had trouble adjusting to the track.
Well, other than the extreme high speed, no, really, there isn't. It's a fun track to drive, really. I've really enjoyed the place.
Well, it's an entirely different ball game. I'm used to running road courses, and this is my first oval track. So the combination of the high speed and being oval, you have to play the corners entirely different. You play them almost like a straightaway, and that's something that takes me a lot of getting used to, I think. And I don't have any trouble with the first turn here on the front straight. That seems natural to get into there and in the fast line, but on number three, I still want to play it like a sports car.
The only place I seem to have trouble on this racetrack is the number two turn. It seems to flatten out just a little bit, and I have a harder time getting off it than I do any place else. The other turn is like number three turn is, if all four was like it, anybody could run around here, I think, 180 miles. Now you can get through it with no trouble at all. But we're not sure. I understand there are some extra bumps that have been developed this year due to weather, snow or something, and it's giving us some trouble in the first turn.
I know it's a lot bumpier. That's one of the reasons that we're finding the speed so difficult to attain. That's the reason for the big separation between the piston car speeds and the jet speed. With their big exhaust pipe, it's pointing straight up in the air. They're getting 70 pounds of thrust straight up in the air, which is actually pushing the car down to the ground 70 pounds worth, and they're not flying through the air going over the bumps in number one corner like what we are. And this has a detrimental factor on your speed.
And how does a veteran driver see the speedway? Well, what does he look for?
Well, the biggest thing you have to worry about is what the other fellow is doing. You're running at such a high rate of speed that you have to drive a long ways in front of you. And if you see somebody in trouble, let's say, 100 yards at least in front of you, well, you're gonna be there before you really know what's going on, you know. And they have no control over the car, so this is one thing that you have to watch out for, is the other fellow. And as far as speed goes, you have to be careful not to get down in the corner too deep and then get back after too late, because this cuts back your speed. Well, the thing you have to remember about this racetrack is you have two long straightaways and two short straightaways. You can make more time, or you can make faster time, by accelerating hard through the short end of the racetrack than you can driving real deep down the long straightaways and then braking hard and then picking up the accelerator and trying to get across the short end of the track. You just have to keep building up your momentum across the short end of the racetrack, and as you do, you find yourself backing off sooner and sooner down the long straight.
Well, it's the way I look at it. It's four individual turns and four straightaways, two long ones and two short ones, and each one has to be approached properly, and if you don't, you'll lose time on the clocks. As far as the jets and the piston engines are concerned, now the jet cars haven't been running on a mile track, so we don't really know how they'll run. And we have some 20-odd races in a season.
Well, really, you can run all over the world and no racetrack will prepare you for Indianapolis. This is a whole new ball game when you get here. There's nothing really that you could compare this to. It's like perhaps running or practicing driving your car in your back alley, so to speak, and then pull out on an interstate. There's considerable difference there, and there's considerable difference here. The speeds are terrific, and the track is narrow, and it's very demanding. It calls for a study in precise precision driving and strictly with the throttle, and there's no guesswork allowed here.
Automobile racing is a dangerous sport, and those who participate in it know the chances they take. Don Edmonds and Al Herman describe what it's like to be in an accident.
Oh, my eyes get kind of big and my hair stands on end a little bit. All you see is grandstand, racetrack, just flashes of everything. I know the first time I ever got upside down, actually, was the first race I ever drove. I didn't know that I was getting upside down. It happened so quick, I didn't know what was happening. And I thought I was just getting through the corner, and I thought, gee, this race is awful rough. Just kind of took away my interest there for about a month or so. I thought, gee, I don't know if I like this or not. You know,
I hit the wall three times coming down a straightaway here. And every time I hit, I just kept thanking the Lord that I was still alive, because I had knocked the wind out of me, but I was still feeling awful good because I knew I was still...
In 1955, Bill Vukovich, who was attempting to become the first driver in history to win three consecutive 500s, however, while leading on the 57th lap, Bill was fatally injured in a four-car accident. The officials at the Speedway take every precaution to ensure the safety of the drivers. Tony Holman, president of the Speedway, holds a driver's meeting before every race.
I know how much you all want to win the race. I don't blame you. There's a lot of hazards here and a lot of danger. And let's have just a little heart for everybody and everything down there tomorrow and try to get this over without any accidents or anything like that. And try to be what you all are, champions. When you go down there, let's look like we're a regular racing organization and we know how to start a race. And from the bottom of my heart, I hope every one of you the best of luck.
And now...
Now, now, cried the Queen. Faster, faster. And a little later in Through the Looking Glass, Lewis Carroll had the Queen remark, "It takes all the running you can do to keep in the same place. If you want to get somewhere else, you must run at least twice as fast as that." This is the place where everyone is going faster and faster. It was appropriately named the Indianapolis Speedway, and no one here has ever kept running in the same place. In 1925, Peter Paolo, driving a Duesenberg, became the first Indianapolis winner to average more than 100 miles per hour when he averaged 101.13 miles per hour for the 500 miles. A unique entry that year was the first front-wheel drive car at Indianapolis, entered by Miller Engine Works and driven to second place by Dave Lewis. Lou Schneider won the 1931 500 in this Bull Seal Fast Special, powered by an 8-cylinder Miller engine, despite a challenge from many passenger car manufacturers. Miller engines finished first, third, and fourth, while the only threat from the semi-stocks came from Studebaker, who finished fifth. A Cummings diesel, the first ever entered at Indy, proved its dependability by going the full distance without a pit stop, but finished an unimpressive 13th. The Miller engine, under its new owner, Fred Offenhauser, continued its supremacy by capturing the first four places in 1934, and Kelly Petillo won in this Miller-powered car in 1935, as the first 12 finishers were Miller engines. Wilbur Shaw, the 1937 winner, interrupted the long string of 11 consecutive Miller-Offenhauser victories by leading the field home in 1939 and 1940 at the wheel of this Maserati imported from Italy in 1941. Harry Miller designed this four-wheel drive car, the Gulf Oil Miller Special, with a six-cylinder engine mounted behind the driver. It was the first rear-engine car to qualify at Indianapolis. The car placed 28th and was forced out after completing only 22 laps with transmission trouble. 1946 was the year of the fabulous Novi when it was born. Ralph Hepburn piloted the powerful V8 engine to a new one-lap record of 134.499 miles per hour and a qualifying speed of 133.944 miles per hour, 5 miles per hour faster than anyone else. This crowd-pleaser and sentimental favorite qualified for the pole position 6 times during its 20-year history, but never won a 500. In the late 40s and early 50s, many new innovations came to Indianapolis. Lighter metals enabled designers to attain better power-to-weight ratios. Improved tires and fuel additives contributed to a steady increase in speed. Bill Vukovich won in 1953 with a new roadster-type car with the engine and drive shaft offset to the left. He also became the first driver in 500 history to average better than 130 miles an hour for the full distance. 1961 was the first threat to the Offenhauser reign at Indianapolis when the Cooper Car Company of England entered a rear-engine Cooper Climax driven by Jack Brabham. The pre-race prediction that the rear-engine car would revolutionize closed-circuit racing in this country appeared premature. The British entry finished ninth, a full 8 minutes behind winner A.J. Foyt driving a conventional Offey Roadster. The foreign invasion was on by 1963, and the days of the Roadsters were numbered. Colin Chapman brought over a team of rear-engine Ford-powered Lotuses from England, and with Scotsman Jim Clark and American Dan Gurney driving them, it took an exceptional effort by Parnelli Jones to win in an Offey. Speed was also in the news. This was the first year qualifiers averaged over 150 miles per hour as 7 drivers bettered the mark. A Scotsman completed the remodeling of the world's biggest automobile race, May 31, 1965. Jim Clark of Doon, Scotland, had buried an era in the first rear-engine car to ever win the Rich 500. The Offenhauser engine in its present form had had it, as Ford-powered cars swept 7 of the first 10 standings. The Ford Motor Company had finally ended the three-decade reign of the four-cylinder Offey engine that had won 17 straight Memorial Day Classics and 24 of the previous 27 races starting in 1934. Andy Granatelli has made the turbine a definite threat. This year, 3 have qualified. 2 are in the front row, and both have averaged over 170 miles per hour. The turbines, however, are not too popular with some of the drivers.
I don't like them. Well, if the rules aren't changed, if they're let like they are, the turbines obviously have an advantage in a properly designed automobile, and it definitely will obsolete millions of dollars worth of racing equipment, you know, to delve into it just a little bit. I personally am of my own personal belief, and I'm stuck with it, that the turbines don't really belong here because this is a race for automobiles, not airplanes.
Well, it's a fast race car. It's awfully expensive, and I don't know how the fans will react to not hearing anything. When you're out there watching one of them, and he's running 165 all by himself, no one else on the track, you can't tell when the driver's on the gas or when he's off the gas. It's just silent. And I don't know how the fans are going to respond to this, but it is a fast race car. There's no getting around that.
Well, definitely, if they don't outlaw them, they're going to be here to stay. It's going to be an awful quiet race when they get all 33 of them out there, though. Well, I think right now the fans, these turbines, they're fascinating them because of the fact that they are an airplane engine, more or less. But when you get it all that way, then I don't think the fans would even like it, because you'd almost have to run a lawnmower so that people listening on the radio would even know anything was going on.
I think probably next year, probably half the field will be turbines at the rate they're going now if they finish the race. I think so. I think it'll be either two classes or it'll just be a struggle of piston engine against the jet engine, and they'll just try to even out the competition so both can run together.
Well, it's definitely going to make a change in racing if they keep on the turbine, because they're not going to their limit with the turbine.
It's a tense moment for drivers, car owners, and mechanics when the search for speed builds to a climax as past winners and sons of past winners get set to qualify for choice starting positions. Each year, the speeds get faster and faster. Is there a limit to how fast a car can go at Indianapolis?
Well, there no doubt is a limitation, but I don't think that we'll reach it within 10 years or so, and maybe not even then. The thing that keeps making the speed go up is we keep improving everything, the race car in general. The tires, I think, are probably the greatest advancement in speed that's been here in 15 or 20 years. Just in the last 6 or 7 years, the speeds have jumped 20 miles an hour. And most of this, I'd say 70% of this, is due to the tires. We also have new type machinery that we're running. The engines are putting out a little more power. The chassis are a little more sophisticated. It builds up our corner speed. This is the thing that makes you go faster on any racetrack, is getting through the corner faster. To do this, you have to have a chassis that works very well at high speed through the corner so that you can come off at a higher RPM or a higher speed to build up your straightaway speed.
You know, years ago they said it was impossible around 140, and then they said 150, and it's going right on up, as you say, so they're improving the breed of equipment, the tires, engines, and chassis and everything, so really I'd be afraid to say that there's any certain stopping point.
Oh, I have my serious doubts that there's any limit to anything. 100 years ago, look at the progress, the airplanes 10 years ago, they said sound barrier was impossible. Now it's a sonic barrier. No, I don't think there's any limit.
Every year the corner speeds are better, and they're better tires, the cars handle better, so it's hard to tell. 4 or 5 years ago, they thought you wouldn't reach 150, and now they're running 170. So I imagine in another 3 or 4 years, they'll be running 180. The suspension systems on the cars, more horsepower, the engines, and better tires. Each year, one's a little bit ahead of the other, and then it takes a year or two for all three to catch up, and there's constant advances all the time.
No, they will never be no limit on this racetrack what they will reach, because they keep, you know, things keep turning over and changing every year. Like your piston displaced engines just went to turbines, and after turbines, it's allowed to be rockets or something, you know.
Fever has been a presentation of TV 18 Sports, brought to you by Hudson Furniture, 1105 Winchester Road, and by First Security National Bank.
Leads these exotic jewels of speed out onto the track for one of the most grueling events in racing. 1,243 miles, 327 laps around Daytona's Tri-Oval and through its road course. The cars move up tight now for the running start. Surtees in number 77 Ferrari, the fastest qualifier on the pole. Car number 72 Ford GT, Bob Bondurant on the outside. And the race is on. Before the race is even one lap old, the Ford-Ferrari battle begins. Bob Bondurant slashes into the first turn and turns that Ford GT loose. After one lap, it'll become a road race as track stewards set out the pylons marking the entrance to the road course. Bondurant is flying in that low, sleek GT. But wait a minute! He smashes right through the pylons and grinds down on his binders as Surtees slips his Ferrari into first place. Bondurant gets back in the race, but he's way back in the field now. Dan Gurney charges up into the third spot and takes after Hanskin and Surtees. He's up on Hanskin now and passes to take second. Now he moves in on Surtees, the world road racing champion in that red Ferrari. Coming off the road course, it's number 77 Surtees in the lead. Gurney number 44 Lotus Ford running second. Hanskin is third, followed by the Cobras. But Dan Gurney wants the lead now. He pops the cork on that Lotus and watch him move. He takes Surtees and stretches his lead. His car is moving now at over 180 miles an hour. Gurney's car, called the Pace Setter, is proving to be just that. He's averaging 110 miles an hour. That's 7 miles an hour faster than his practice laps. And Surtees is running 3 miles per hour slower than his qualifying speed. So you wonder, who's hot and who's playing it cool? Jerry Grant, Gurney's co-driver, looks happy. Pedro Rodriguez, who drives with Surtees, looks worried. Look out! Fire on the front chute. Dave Howe pulls number 47 Jaguar off the track and bails out. This Jag is a little too hot. Early in the race, the lead cars have lapped far into the field. Watch it now. Gurney is in a box. There he goes. He finds a hole and threads the needle, and that red Ferrari is right on his tail. 47 is the first car out, the Jaguar. After 10 laps, it's Gurney in the lead. Number 77, Surtees second. Hanskin third. Look out! Hanskin spins it all the way around. Now, Now there's only one Ferrari ahead of the four GTs and Cobras. Hanskin dodges traffic as he heads back to the pits on foot. Look out, another one goes. But that GT is all right. He heads off the grass and goes back onto the track and into the race. Dan Gurney charges through the field and dives into the road course. But wait a minute, here's the Ferrari. Sergis is the first of the leaders to pit. He comes in European style, no hurry. He may even have a cup of tea. After all, it's a 12-hour race. But the Cobras pit American style. They don't waste a second. The Shelby crews have brought a whole new system to sports car racing. Pedro Rodriguez, winner of the last two Continentals, takes over from John Surtees. That Ferrari is still running second, but the GTs and Cobras are closing up on him. Gurney pits. He's shattered all the track records up to now. The tremendous thrust on the high banks and the pounding on the straights has created some handling problems. His crew rebalances the wheel. Rodriguez, the number 77, is in a hurry. He wants to get that lap back. Dan's car is okay, but he's not changing off with Jerry Grant. He wants to beat the Ferraris personally. The fuel line is swung out of the way, and Dan Gurney goes out the leader. Wait a minute. On the third turn, Rodriguez slows down to a stop. Gurney is still coming on like Mr. Clean looking for dirt. The tires blew on that Ferrari, beating the rear end and battering the car to pieces. Now Gurney can relax. He ran the Ferraris into the ground. He beat them. He'll let Jerry Grant go out now and battle the GTs and the Cobras. With a new battery, Rodriguez is going to try to get the Ferrari underway. He's got a mile and a half to carry it. If he succeeds, he'll be miles behind the leader. In Grand Prix racing, a driver is totally responsible for his machine as long as it's on the course. Grant has time to talk things over with Gurney. Needless to say, a 15-pound battery on a half-mile hike is a job in itself. Well, the pace setter now has a five-lap lead over 19 miles on the closest competition. Rodriguez ran out of car, but he has enough courage left for a dozen men. The Ford-powered cars hold the first five places, unchallenged. It's Shelby's race. Go out and get him. As the grind goes on, some drivers push too hard. Heat and fatigue start to take over. Sometimes you don't know whether you're coming or going. There's 22 cars still running. The nearest non-American entry is a Porsche running in the sixth spot. Watch it. Here's an unscheduled pit stop for the pace setter. Lloyd Ruby gets set to take out the second place GT. The pace setter is out of the race with a cracked piston, and Ruby rides off into first place. After a record-breaking 825 miles, Gurney and Grant's ride ends in a heartbreak. Now it's GT, Cobra, Cobra, GT, and Cobra up front. And Carroll Shelby's dream is coming true. On into the floor tonight. The crews flash instructions to their drivers. The final precautionary pit stop. The boys make sure everything is go for the final two-hour push to the checkered flag. Most crews perform miracles. Even in the dark, they're in and out in a hurry. On the last lap, Ruby in GT number 73 has a 5-lap lead over the Cobra number 13. And the long one is over, and the American entries have won. They've overthrown the Ferraris in just 3 short years of competition. And not only that, it's a clean sweep for America, with the Fords taking the first 5 places. They proved they had the speed, and even more important, the stamina, to run fast and long. 2,000 kilometers in 12 hours, 27 minutes and 9 seconds. A finish for the record books.
Come on, all I want to do is laugh. Come on, I'll make you laugh. If you want to hear bells go ring, ring a ding ding ding. If you want to hear tambourine go ching ching ching. If you want to hear bells go ring, if you want to hear tambourine ching ching. If you want to make a smile, come on, make a smile and laugh. If you want to hear the drums go boom, boom, boom. If you want to hear the drums go boom, boom, boom. If you want to hear bells ring. If you want to hear me sing. If you want to make a smile, want to make a laugh. Hear the drums go boom, boom.
Brother, that's the way we say hello in Hawaii. Just a simple greeting. Such a simple thing, but really a big thing. A greeting with a lot of warmth, feeling, just like the people who live here. We're all descendants of immigrants here, people from all over. Just like everybody from the other 49 states. Except we're mixed a little different. For instance, my grandma is pure Hawaiian, my grandpa is pure Chinese, and my mother's side have Portuguese, German, Dutch. Everybody else here is about as mixed up as I am. The minorities are the majorities, you might say. And we really can't put each other down because We've got a little bit of what everybody else has got. And that's what Hawaii is all about. This is Kamehameha School. To get in, you have to be part Hawaiian. Hawaiian kids who come here have names like Kili'ipuli'ole, O'Brien, Rodriguez, Goldstein, even Hope. I went to school here. And every day is like homecoming day whenever I come here to pick up my kids. Of course, you gotta find them first. In most cases, CAM is like any American school. One thing special, though, everybody sings. Oh.